all across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And good afternoon. This is Jim Fossone for Veterans Radio, broadcasting from WAAM in Ann Arbor. We're glad to have you on board today. Dale is on TDY, and Bob is off doing a little R&R, and they've left the ship in my hands. We've got a great show for you. And in the first half hour, we're going to talk about the commissioning ceremonies for the USS Detroit and the upcoming VA Golden Age Games that are also coming to the Detroit area this summer. But before we get to that, we're going to start with a little bit of updated information. You always should have that pen or pencil ready to take this stuff down when we give it to you. We wanted to let you know that the VVA of America, VVA Chapter 528 out of Plymouth, Canton, Michigan, is going to host its Agent Orange Education Campaign on May 21st at Vista Tech Auditorium at Schoolcraft College. It runs from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Veterans Radio has participated in this in the past. It's very educational. We encourage all Vietnam veterans and their family members to go learn about the impact of Agent Orange and the impact that it has on your descendants as well. You can learn more by going to VVA528.org and look for the Agent Orange Education Campaign logo. And that, again, town hall is May 21st, 2016 in Livonia, Michigan. We also wanted to congratulate and wish good luck to the new director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Administration, Jim Redford. Director Redford takes over. He was a 28-year Navy captain, retired. He also is an attorney. He was a judge in Kent County for a number of years. He's part of Governor Snyder's camp inner circle, I suppose I'll call it. And we wish him luck in making sure that the services veterans need are available to them. And finally, we wanted to mention one phone number, an 800 number, that may be of value to our veterans. We're hearing a lot of concern about the Veterans Choice Card. The Veterans Choice Card is to allow veterans who have difficulty getting into VA hospitals to go ahead and see private physicians. But unfortunately, we've had a little bit of problem that we're hearing from veterans who are off trying to do that, that they're having some challenges getting their private physicians or private medical care approved, and that what they instead find themselves stuck with is some debt or debt collection issues that they really weren't expecting. So VA has set up a hotline, an 800 number, where you can call and get some help on your billing issues related to the VA Choice Card. That number is 877-881-7618. And again, if you've been struggling with getting VA to approve your private physicians or have gone off to the private physician thinking that you were covered only to find out they are not covering it, then I'd encourage you to call 877-881-7618. So those are a couple of quick things we wanted to mention to you. We also will pass along that there's a very interesting museum in Greenville, Michigan. So this is sort of central portion of the state of Michigan. It has a Fighting Falcon glider replica at the museum. This is the type of glider that was used during World War II. It's a Fighting Falcon CG-4A. It was used during the D-Day invasion, and those gliders were sent off, designed, if you will, to crash in France. If you want to see some of the very interesting aviation that the Fighting Falcon did. We'd encourage you to go to the museum there in Greenville, Michigan. You can get more information by going to www.thefightingfalcon.com. We are privileged to have as our guest today United States Navy Commander Michael Desmond. Michael Desmond is the commanding officer of the USS Detroit. Commander, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me, and it's certainly an honor to be on your show today.
Well, this is a really exciting interview to hear about what the new USS Detroit's going to be doing and the nature of the ship, but we don't get to talk to many Navy commanders, so this is kind of a real honor for us here at Veterans Radio. Commander, tell us a little bit about your Navy career.
Oh, well, started back in 94. You know, actually, I was had never really had aspirations of being in the service. I was looking at going to graduate school at Syracuse University for forestry and mapping, and that wasn't working out too well, so mostly because of finances. And I said, you know, I think I'd like to go in the Navy, and I know they have the GI Bill and a number of other programs. So there I was in the Navy, enlisted as an electronics technician, served aboard the USS John F. Kennedy for a couple of years, and received an appointment to go to Officer Candidate School. And I went there after about 4 years of enlisted service, commissioned in 1998, and my subsequent tours included service on cruisers, USS Monterey in particular, CG-61. I was on the George Washington for a time, and my department head tour was on USS Bulkley, which is a destroyer number 84, DDG-84, out of Norfolk, Virginia. I was a weapons officer and combat systems officer. I did a tour at the Damage Control Assistant School in Rhode Island, and after my department head tours, I went on to service at the Pentagon, spent some time in Iraq in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. I went to the U.S. Africa Command in Stuttgart, Germany, which was a great tour, and after some training, specialized training, I came to the LCS program, Littoral Combat Ship Program, as the executive officer of Crew 103, and then I fleeted up to the commanding officer of the crew. We did time last year on board USS Fort Worth, which is another littoral combat ship, number 3, over in, based out of Singapore, our logistics hub was Singapore, and we did a 4-month deployment there. I fleeted up to CO this past September and awaiting moving up to Marinette with my crew to sail the good ship USS Detroit around back here to San Diego.
Well, that's quite a run around the world there, isn't it, in terms of different assignments. It's been quite a career.
I've been very blessed, and it has been. It's been a wonderful time. I can't imagine having done anything else in terms of a career. I've been very blessed and got to see a lot of interesting places, got to take part in a lot of, I think, important missions, and, of course, serve alongside a lot of great sailors and folks from other services as well along the way.
You said you didn't really have an initial interest in the military. Was there a family history that sort of leaned you that way, or was it really, maybe I'll go in and get the GI Bill and go on and get some more education?
That's right. My goal was really get civilian education, and back in the early 90s, the economy wasn't doing so great, so I had to really look closely at some of my options. My folks thought that I was well-suited for military service, but I wasn't quite as confident. So I didn't pursue that right out of school. I went to college right after high school. I got my bachelor's degree from Plattsburgh State University up in way upstate New York, and then decided that my future really wasn't in the civilian world. I thought I would try out the military.
Well, you picked up your bachelor's degree in environmental science, and you ultimately used your time wisely and picked up a master's degree in diplomacy and military science. So it's always interesting when talking to our guests to sort of find the career path that they found themselves on in their chosen military profession, and how over time they've picked up more education that's helped them move along in their military career. And it sounds like that's occurred in your instance as well.
Yes, sir. And I knew that my parents were so instrumental in building my interests and obviously my development. I just knew that, I knew I really couldn't go wrong because I had such a strong foundation from my family. My dad was in the Air Force for a bit. He was a New York State trooper. He's the county sheriff right now of Schoharie County, New York. And my mom, you know, served in the bank industry for a while in my hometown in upstate New York. So I had a very strong foundation and very fortunate in that regard.
Absolutely. Obviously they're very, very proud of their son becoming a commander and now commanding officer of his own ship. Tell us a little bit about the USS Detroit.
The USS Detroit, this will be the sixth ship named for the great city of Detroit. The first, as you know, was captured from the British in the War of 1812. I think it was during the Battle of Lake Erie in 1813. That was the first ship that was converted to the USS Detroit, and we've had several others. I think the most recent one was an oiler replenishment ship, USS Detroit, and currently the ship is in Marinette, Wisconsin, at the shipbuilding facility there, and it's going through some testing right now, final building trials, and it will be delivered a little bit later this year and then ultimately commissioned and sailed around to join the fleet.
So tell us a little bit about what a littoral combat ship is all about.
Okay. LCS's littoral combat ships are really the Navy's newest class of warships, one of the newest, and comprised of two different variants. You've heard of the trimaran hull and the monohull. Well, Detroit is part of the Freedom variant. That's all the odd-numbered hulls, if you will. And then the Independence variant are all the even-numbered hulls. So I mentioned we have USS Freedom, which is LCS-1, then USS Fort Worth, number 3, Milwaukee, number 5, and then Detroit will be number 7. So we have the Freedom variants are the monohull type, and Independence are the trimaran. Really, their role in the fleet is to contribute to a lot of the Navy's different mission areas, depending on what the type of operation is. And we actually have three different types of mission packages that we can embark or change out depending on what the mission at hand is. And these ships are magnificent warships. They're designed to operate in either open oceans or in shallow areas, which is really littoral. That's where that name comes from. And that can be as part of a strike group or independently as well.
These aren't dimension-wise. Why don't you give us the dimensions of these, Commander? They're not particularly long, if you will, and they're not particularly deep in terms of their draft, which allows them to go into that shallow or littoral area.
That's right. That's one of the unique capabilities of the ship. It's actually about just shy of 400 feet long. It's about 57 feet wide, and it draws relatively shallow, about 14 feet. In depth, of course, that varies depending on what equipment is embarked, but the ship only displaces a little over 3,000 tons. To put that in perspective, an aircraft carrier displaces, I think, just over 90,000 tons, and a destroyer, for instance, is about 9,000 tons. So these ships, LCSs, are about one-third as big as a guided missile destroyer, the Arleigh Burke class, and about, if my public math is correct, about 1/30th as big as an aircraft carrier.
But these guys got speed for them, don't they? Give us the sort of top end for what a LCS is going to run and maybe what the normal cruising range would rate would be.
Well, it's all based on the unique engine types that we have. We have main propulsion diesel engines, which are normal. We have two of those, which are normal propulsion means. And our normal cruising speed is anywhere between 8 and 13 knots. And our top speed, once we light off our additional propulsion means, which are gas turbine engines, we can go in excess of 40 knots, which is about 47 miles per hour. So certainly one of the fastest ships in the Navy.
And tell us a little bit about the crew that will be on board the USS Detroit or any, for that matter, any Freedom-class littoral combat ship.
Well, another one of the unique features of littoral combat ships is the relatively smaller crew size. It's an optimal manning concept. and the crew size is about 55 men and women, officers and sailors, which is about a third or a fourth of what some of the comparable ships in the Navy have. A frigate, for instance, which are decommissioned, had about 180 folks on board. So we have about 55 core crew members, and when we deploy, we will normally embark a mission package team, which is about 24 personnel, and that can be surface warfare mission package, anti-submarine, or mine warfare mission package, depending, as I said before, on the mission. So we have 55 core crew, about 19 mission package personnel, then there'd be 24 aviation personnel, including pilots, maintainers, and operators for the helicopters we have on board.
So before we get to the aviation, the helicopters, talk a little bit more about the modular mission package approach that's being employed with the Freedom class.
Oh, I'd love to, yes. So the mission package concept is really based on the fact that the mission that these ships perform can change relatively rapidly. And presuming that the logistics support capability and the personnel are in place, these ships can pull into port and within a few short days can exchange the mission package that's on board for a different one, depending on the needs. For instance, when we deployed last year on board USS Fort Worth, we had the surface warfare mission package. So not only did they bring an additional 19 personnel with them, they also brought a visit board search and seizure capability, which is really a maritime security element. And they also operated and maintained twin 30-millimeter cannons that we embark on board for self-defense.
Beyond surface warfare, what would be another mission package that this ship would be appropriate for?
The other two mission packages that I believe are in final stages of testing right now are the anti-submarine warfare mission package and the mine warfare mission package. I haven't served with folks that are in those areas, but I know that they're in final stages of development, and I look forward to hopefully being underway on a ship that has one embarked.
Well, let's back up. You mentioned it briefly, and I said we'd get back to it. And we're talking to Commander Michael Desmond here on Veterans Radio. He's going to be the initial commanding officer of the littoral combat ship USS Detroit. Commander, I understand that this class of LCS has a aviation or helicopter component to us. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. We actually have the capability to embark a MH-60 manned helicopter as well as the Fire Scout unmanned helicopter, which is essentially a drone. So when we were based out of Singapore last year on deployment, we had each of those two assets. It was actually a composite aviation detachment. And my understanding is this one was one of the very first times that a composite aviation detachment was ever used operationally over in the 7th Fleet of Operations, certainly the first time on board an LCS. So the traditional roles that the MH-60 Romeo allow us to do include search and rescue, maritime security, things like this. The drone helicopter, the Fire Scout unmanned helicopter, has a lot of those same capabilities. And really one of the limitations of the manned helicopter is it's obviously much bigger. You have pilot fatigue that's involved when the aircraft is out conducting operations. And the Fire Scout can offset some of that. It allows us to kind of extend the workday, if you will, and allow us to get more time on station with that airborne asset than we would normally with a manned asset.
So we've had the chance here on Veterans Radio, Commander, to talk with some of the Air Force leadership regarding their remotely piloted aircraft, they don't like the word drone, programs. If the Fire Scout's on an LCS, is that being operated from the ship or is that being operated back land-based somewhere so that you don't have that fatigue issue?
That's actually being operated by the pilots, the aviators, from onboard the ship. It's actually being controlled from the consoles in our mission control center, which on a lot of ships is called the Combat Information Center. It's where our tactical watchstanders sit, and these aviators, it's been compared a little bit to a video game where the aircraft is actually controlled, and you can actually see, based on the onboard camera, what the aircraft is seeing, so to speak. So it's controlled and operated from consoles onboard the ship by aviators that are pilots.
It's interesting to think about, I think, the advancement of electronics and technology. How does that play itself out into a brand new class of ships that the Navy's deploying? I have a feeling that the electronics on the USS Detroit and the other littoral combat ships is probably nothing like what you worked on as an electronics technician when you signed up in 1994.
That's true. The radar system that I first worked on, we don't have on board, but the systems are quite advanced, and really what allows us to have the optimal manning, one of the things is the fact that we have a lot of sensors on board and automation, which enables that reduced manning. Equipment can be monitored by closed-circuit television screens, and valves, pumps, and other equipment can be operated, monitored, and maintained remotely. So that's part of what gives the ship its lighter weight and, in effect, its higher speed.
I suspect the sailors who will be on your ship really have to be at the top of their game and more advanced in these sort of technologies than ever before.
I believe so. We have not only a smaller crew, but we have a relatively more senior crew than on other ships. The majority of my crew are E5 and above, and in the Navy, second class petty officer and above. So they have, almost all of them, previous sea duty experience, and I think they're the best of the best, the brightest, the hardest working, and the most capable sailors that I've ever served with. And that's what makes us able to get the mission done with a relatively small complement of crew.
Well, it's a very interesting, Commander, to have the opportunity to talk to you. And before the time gets away, I wanted you to tell us a little bit about the commissioning ceremony that will be coming up for the USS Detroit later this year. So why don't you give us the current status of that ceremony?
Well, the ceremony itself, obviously a lot goes into it still, and we're working with a lot of different parties to have that organized. But I should first back up and say that the ship is in final stages right now of its testing and building processes up in Marinette, Wisconsin at the shipyard there. So presuming everything goes smoothly and according to plan, our intention collectively is to sail away the ship from Marinette, Wisconsin, obviously via the Great Lakes, and hopefully in the latter part of September, we'll have a commissioning week at the Renaissance Center facility in downtown Detroit at the Riverwalk. So the plan is to have it a week-long series of events. So the ship would pull in, we would have tours probably by maybe some veterans group, school groups, things like that, and the week would culminate in a commissioning ceremony where the ship is formally commissioned into service and therefore sails away and joins the fleet after circumnavigating the continental United States through the Panama Canal and then back here to San Diego.
What a fantastic opportunity to get up close and personal. It'll dock right downtown then, is what you're telling us.
That's the plan. Right in front of the Renaissance Center, right at the waterfront there, we had the good fortune of giving a tour of the downtown area, the Riverwalk, when I was in town last week with a few of my crew members in Detroit. We met with the Port Authority personnel and Senator Carl Levin and his lovely wife, Barbara, who's the ship's sponsor, gave us a tour of the Riverwalk area. And I think it's a wonderful place, a wonderful venue for such a ceremony. Of course, looking across to the great city of Windsor, just across the river. I think it will be a fantastic ceremony.
Commander, do you have a website or information that folks can follow to keep an eye on when that's all going to happen and how they might be able to participate?
For the commissioning event itself, that's if folks Google, I don't have the website available right now, but if folks Google USS Detroit commissioning, the information should pop right up.
And I have a website. I just didn't know if it's right. You can tell me if it's not. But I believe folks can keep track of this at USSDetroitLCS7.com.
That sounds correct. Yes, sir.
And that'll give you more information about the USS Detroit and the USS Detroit Commissioning Committee by going to USSDetroitLCS7.com. And you'll be able to find out more about when the USS Detroit is coming through and that, and participate in that whole week of events and certainly get out and take a tour if you get a chance. I want to thank Commander Michael Desmond, who's the commanding officer of the Littoral Combat Ship USS Detroit, which we all anticipate being commissioned later this fall. I want to thank our listeners to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer here at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com.
Nothing offers an opportunity to bond and give thanks quite like breaking bread together. This is especially true for our service members traveling far from home. Hi, I'm Gary Sinise. Since 2011, the Gary Sinise Foundation's Serving Heroes program has shown gratitude to our nation's defenders and their families by serving up more than 60,000 hearty classic American meals at travel hubs and military locations. And now, thanks to our friends at Bob Evans Farms, their Purple Barn, and their Our Farm Salutes program, we'll be able to provide even more meals nationwide. Serving Heroes offers our defenders a moment of togetherness with a taste of home. Help us show America's gratitude through food and fellowship. Look for the Purple Barn at your grocery store and visit ourfarmsalutes.com or GarySinisFoundation.org to learn more. While we can never do enough to support the men and women who serve, we can always do a little more.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. Legal Help for Veterans is a veteran disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Our guest today on Veterans Radio is a very unique veteran. I want to introduce to our listeners Chris Morris. Chris, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Jim.
Well, you have the unique distinction of having seen military life both from that in the Navy and in the Army. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? I know you have a Bachelor's of Arts from Drury College in Springfield, Missouri, and that you joined the U.S. Navy in 1997. But walk us through that military history a little bit.
Jim, well, it all started actually in 1996. I graduated college, and I had a very bad injury to my hand. It was a dog bite. And they were actually going to cut my hand off. It was a bad, bad injury. But through some very good health care, they were able to save my left hand, and I was able to get full use. But I realized at that time that something that I had always wanted to do was to earn my citizenship, I thought, to earn it. And the best way I felt of doing that was serving the country. My father was in the Navy, and that's where I was leaning towards. Plus, Top Gun was playing on TNT nonstop for 24 hours. You can't go wrong with that playing, you know?
Absolutely. That makes it all the more exciting. But tell us a little bit about what you wanted to do when you entered the Navy, and maybe it was sort of what you were promised you'd be able to do.
Well, I originally wanted to be a military intelligence officer in the Navy. That's what my dad was. And that was not in the cards due to needs of the Navy, as we like to say. The quotas just weren't there to be filled. So I ended up becoming a surface warfare officer, which is a ship driver. I served on the USS Princeton and got to experience some very interesting situations. I was in Operation Desert Fox, which is when Saddam Hussein threw the UN inspectors out of Iraq, and my ship was proud enough to send some love down towards him to help him reconsider his decision and thinking. It was a good time. It was a good time because I met a lot of great people, a lot of great camaraderie, and then from there I moved on to being a operations officer on a or at a MEPS, which is a military entrance processing station, and that's where everybody has to go to basically enter the service. And I'm sure your veterans who are listening to this broadcast remember, you know, the medical exams, the ASVAB test, all that stuff. I was involved with that, and I worked with the recruiters to help get those individuals into the respective services. I have the, I would say, proud privilege of being able to have sworn in over 2,000 young men and women into all the services, which to me is one of the most fulfilling things. I know that oath of enlistment down pretty well. I can still do it to this day.
So let me flesh this out a little bit, because you were active duty Navy for about, was it 5 years?
Actually, in all, it came to about 13, because I had some reserve service in there that broke it up. After that MEPS tour, I just hadn't felt I'd earned it yet. So I took some orders to Saudi Arabia, where I spent some time doing force protection work. And really it came down to anti-terrorism work. And that was my first introduction to anti-terrorism. And I absolutely fell in love with it. It is a great concept. Counterterrorism, those are our Navy SEALs, our Green Berets. They go find the bad guy. Anti-terrorism, we keep the bad guy from hurting us. So it's about protecting your assets, protecting your people, and very much enjoyed that, and it became a, you know, it was a successful tour for me. But after a year in all over the Middle East, I needed some time to decompress, so I got out of the active duty service, and it took about 2 months before I needed to get back to where I had a comfort level, and that was the reserves for me. So in February of 2004, I became a reserve officer, drilling reservist, where I would do the one weekend a month, 2 weeks out of the year, with a Naval Coastal Warfare Squadron. And they also did anti-terrorism work, defense in depth kind of things, for protecting big shipping cargo ships coming into ports. We provided the security for that.
So. And listeners, we're talking to Chris Morris. Chris, where did you do your Naval Reserve drill out of?
It was Seal Beach, California.
And that reserve status lasted for a couple of years. Tell us what happened.
Well, from 2004 to 2006, I was a drilling reservist. Then in 2006, I got mobilized. During the years from 2004 to 2006, I also became a stockbroker with Edward Jones. So I got a financial, I passed my Series 7. I have a financial planning type background. Not a professional CFP, not a professional certified financial planner, but I got introduced to it, and I did planning with families when it came to, you know, their investments, their retirement, that kind of thing, but not in a certified sense. I want to make sure I put that caveat out there. That's a more extensive training, and it's a certification you have to get, and I'm not going to say something I'm not.
Well, and this is part of what happens in the reserves, right? You've got a regular job, you got your full-time job as a stockbroker, and you're layering in your naval reserve activities, and then you got recalled to active duty, I think, in 2006.
Yes, sir. I was a citizen soldier or citizen sailor in this case, and I was mobilized in 2006, and I really tip my hat to Edward Jones. They did a great job in allowing me to do the training I needed when I needed to do it. They're just a great company to work for, very family-oriented company. I can't say any bad things about them,
I think it's really important for our employers out there to realize that the whole structure of our military nowadays really relies on citizen soldiers, and these instances occur because there are things happening in the world where certain talents of reservists are necessary. And you got moved from that reserve status to active duty in 06 for the next, what, couple of years?
Yes, I did a deployment for a year where I went back to the Middle East. They never send me to Europe. Nope, it's always the Middle East. So
yeah, nice assignments, right?
Exactly. I got to work on my tan a lot. But the bottom line was spent more time doing the anti-terrorism work. I was very good at it. I was a force protection watch officer. I had fun. I mean, I was doing the job I was trained to do, and I get a lot of pride in that. And that's something that I like to see in the young sailors and soldiers coming up. When they're actually out there doing it, there's such pride in what they do because they're doing what they're trained to do. And there's a feeling of empowerment and a feeling of being something that's bigger than yourself.
You had a unique opportunity to transition from the Navy, where you were a lieutenant commander by that point, to a major in the Army. Tell us why you made that transition.
That's a great question. My dad was getting sick, and I took orders home to St. Louis to spend the last few years with him. When you do that in the Navy, it took me off my career path. And the Navy was very honest and said, look, you're just not competitive for promotion to 05, which was full commander. And I accepted that. And the Army had an opportunity where they said, we have this new program we want you to look at in military intelligence. And I thought to myself, well, I always wanted to do military intelligence. This is,
right, exactly.
This is Providence. So I went and did what was called the Blue to Green program. And in July of 2009, I was a lieutenant commander in the Navy. And by September of 2009, I was a major in the Army. They transitioned my rank over and my seniority over and everything. I mean, it was the Army was very good to me in that aspect.
And as you say, the Army, knowing that you liked the Middle East so much, decided you should go back.
Yes, they did.
That was part of Operation Enduring Freedom, I believe.
Yes, sir. I was stationed at Fort Lewis, or now Joint Base Lewis-McChord, up in kind of just outside of Tacoma, Washington, and with First Corps, and we deployed to Afghanistan. I was under Lieutenant General Scaparotti. He was our commanding officer, commanding general. Just a great, great gentleman to work for and work with. And I spent some time down in Kandahar as the Chief of Staff of Force Protection, again, tapping into that anti-terrorism background. And then an opportunity arose in Kabul for a joint intelligence, a J-2, a joint intelligence officer assignment, that I needed for my career. And I jumped at the chance to do that because you have to continue to go up the ladder. It's, you know, up or out. So I switched up to Kabul and I did about 9 months as a J-2, well, maybe a little under nine as a J-2 for the Deputy Commander of Support. Major General Bill Rapp was my commanding officer, another good gentleman.
This deployment was a little bit different, though, this time around, wasn't it, Chris, in that by this point you had been married?
Yes.
And so you were being deployed as and leaving behind a spouse back here in the States.
Yes, sir. That is correct.
And how did that impact that deployment?
It was a different type of stress. When I deployed and I was single, it was just me. I knew my family was my dad, my mom. They were all back home. You know, that unit was fine. But when I went forward, I was worried about my wife, about my family, my direct family now, when it came to, you know, family we're working on. So there was that added stressor. And that was a change for me. And I'll be very honest. My wife will tell you this. I had a rough start the first couple of months. And then a very good friend of mine pulled me aside And after reading me the Riot Act, kind of explained to me, hey, you're not single anymore. And that was important for me. And, you know, I admit my flaws. I did not do as well as I should have the first couple of months. I did not provide the support network I needed to my wife through as frequent communication as she would have liked. And unfortunately, some of that had to do with the nature of my work. Because I was doing military intelligence, I tend to practice OPSEC to a very strong degree, operational security. I don't let my movements be known. I kept my schedules quiet, and that made things difficult. And that was something I had to adjust to, and I had to adapt to make sure that I provided her the network she needed and the communication she needed to know that I was all right, because her not knowing caused her stress, which in turn caused me stress when I did get in touch with her, because she always led me the right way.
We all learn from these things, and part of the reason we do these interviews is to pass along to others some of those pearls of wisdom you learned along the way. But your career didn't end up exactly the way you thought it might, or maybe hoped, after about, I don't know, almost 17, 18 years of service. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how it wound up?
Well, when I jumped into the Army, it was right when they started doing sequestration. Right around that time, so the Army was drawing down. And because I only had 2 to 3 years in the intelligence side of the house compared to individuals who had been in the Army for, you know, 15-plus years, I failed to select for lieutenant colonel. That's just the way it is. Got it. But, no, that's the way it is, and I understand the game. So I had retirement orders, and I was on my way out of the Army. When I was doing my retirement physical, my blood work came back a little wonky. And I remember sitting down with the doc, and the doc said, you have type 2 diabetes. And I looked at this doctor, and I said, that doesn't make any sense. I run because the Army requires me to run. I work out. I'm healthy. I'm 6 foot. I'm not fat by any means. I'm very lean. She said, well, you have, type 2 diabetes. Welcome to America. I refused to accept that answer. So she and I had a conversation. We started ordering a little bit more tests, and we found out that I had actually developed cancer. So I was pulled off of my retirement orders by the Army. My command at Third Army really took care of me. They knew that a military retirement was not as beneficial as a medical retirement for me at that time. And we went through the medical board process. So it's, I had some good colonels who really, really looked out for me. Colonel Battle, John Battle was a great colonel who did so. Colonel Barry Graham, these are good men. Colonel Eric Keyes, that command team really helped me take care of my family as I was transitioning through this process, because to find out I had type 2 diabetes and then on top of that cancer, that's a significant kick in the gut.
Yeah, that's a lot to carry, and particularly for a guy who was in good shape and otherwise feeling good, the medical retirement out as a major was good for you and good for the family should something happen to you. So kudos to the Army command that recognized that and made sure it was taking care of its people.
Yes, sir. And they weren't afraid to have a conversation. And I wasn't afraid to be open with them and ask them and said, what can we do? And they were very forthcoming. And again, three great men who really helped set me up for success. So they pulled me off retirement orders. We started going through the medical board process, and almost a year later, not quite a full year, but almost a year later, I retired medically with just under 18 years. So I was about 17 years and 5 months or 4 months or something like that. But unfortunately, the Army doesn't round up when it comes to that.
Yeah, no. Well, and listeners, we're talking to Chris Morris, who's both a
Navy veteran and an Army veteran who medically retired out as a major after just about 18 years. And, Chris, you then got moved over to the VA healthcare system to deal with those medical conditions, the cancer and the diabetes that had been identified in your in one of your Army physicals. What's your experience been with the VA healthcare?
Good and not so good. I mean, it really is something that, and I tell veterans this, you have to know your body. You have to know when it's time to speak up. And I've had some good, really good experiences with the healthcare with the VA. But initially there were some rough spots. And being that I had been in the military, as long as I had, I understand the government system, and I understood who I needed to go and communicate with appropriately to get the right corrective actions done. And I'm very thankful that we're having this discussion, because I did that so that that private or that lance corporal or that, you know, seaman or airman who maybe only has 2 years in but was hit by an IED or had some other event caused them to go into the VA system, and they're not as knowledgeable in the governmental systems, I look at it as my job still to look out for those guys and girls. So,
I do think that's right. One of the challenges for all the enlisted is that sometimes the VA bureaucracy can really grind them down, and I think the officers have a little better chance of withstanding the grind. You ran into a particular problem that we talked about that I'd like to get your view on, which is your cancer was treated and was in remission for about a year and a half, and the VA looked at that one way, and you were looking at that as another way. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, the VA disability ratings, the big charts that the VA use, they basically say that if you have been without any signs of the cancer for 6 months, they're going to say you're in remission. They're going to reevaluate you and downgrade your cancer to essentially 0%. Now, if you have active malignant cancer, it's 100%. So going from 100% disability to 0% disability is a $3,000 plus change a month. Those are just the facts. Now, every oncologist I have talked to, and these are just the oncologists I've dealt with, have said they're not willing to say someone's in remission at the 6 month point after the last treatment. You're in a surveillance period. And every cancer is different. Every cancer is different. And everybody's body is different. They respond differently to the radiation or the chemotherapy or the immunotherapy, whatever they're being treated with. So to sit there and just systematically across the board, one size fits all, and say, 6 months, yep, you're in remission, cut your benefits. I had oncologists writing letters to the VA saying, this is not right. And these are private doctors, and I actually had some VA docs sit there and say, this is not right. And that's because there's a real split between the doctors and the benefits side of the house at the VA. The doctors provide the information, and the benefit guys, the actuaries and the lawyers, they decide the rating. And they look at that evidence, and they fill in, you know, their charts, and this is what they come up with. But they can only go by the guidelines in the disability charts. So here I get a letter. And I think it was June 28th, I got a letter that said, congratulations, you're in remission, we're knocking it down to 0%. And then not 2 weeks later, 4 weeks later, July 20th, I got word, your cancer's back. So, really, under 20 days, actually 22 days, from the time I was supposedly in remission by the VA, I had cancer again.
Well, I think this is one of those situations where, again, the big bureaucracy maybe needs to take a step back and
focus a little more on the veteran. Fortunately, your situation was able to be addressed in a timely manner in terms of in that regards. But I want to get to, as we're running out of time, I want to get to one more thing, and that is, listeners, Chris Morris has stepped forward and said, hey, I want to continue to serve the public, and is running for the 9th Congressional District in the state of Michigan. Chris, do you feel that veterans sort of have a special role in this kind of public service?
Most definitely. I mean, any veteran provides selfless service. Now I'm going into public service. And I really respect individuals who provide that selfless service, because when you sign that contract, you're giving up part of your rights. You're giving up your freedom of speech at times. You don't have to like it. You just have to do it. It doesn't matter who the party is who controls the White House. Veterans understand that because we took an oath and we abide by it. I think going into public service now as a, you know, I hope to be a future congressman here, that allows us to look at what's good for the country. And people ask me, you know, are you a Republican or a Democrat? And I always tell them, I'm an American first, then I'm a veteran, and then I affiliate myself with the Republicans because I believe in a more limited government, because I've seen what a bureaucracy can do and how when it gets too large, common sense tends to, well, it just doesn't get injected into the situation as much as it should. Point in case, oh, you're cancer-free 6 months after treatment. That's not common sense. I don't know many oncologists who are going to sit there and say that.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about that. As you go forward here, do you carry a stigma of being a veteran or a stigma of being a cancer patient? How do you react to that stigma that I think veterans kind of get? The disease process can change, but we kind of get labeled with.
Well, I would not look at it as a stigma for a veteran. I think it's an honor to be a veteran. To have served this country is an honor, because it's the greatest country in the world. And the reason, you know, people have asked me, suspend your campaign or, you know, drop out of the race. Why? Every day, people go to work with diabetes or they're undergoing cancer treatment. And they don't tell their coworkers. They just go and they do their job. But when people find out, now they're some little brittle eggshell that you can't sit there and touch. That's wrong. You know, being that I'm living with this, I had to tell my campaign team, look, I'm going to have to slow down a little bit to, you know, go through the stuff I need to go through. I'm going to campaign when I can, and I'm going to campaign hard. And when I'm not campaigning, don't think I'm off the clock. Because just because I'm not out there in public doesn't mean I'm not working on policy. I'm not sitting there and trying to reach out to other groups so that they know that I'm going to represent them equally, fairly, with no stigma. And that's something that I think is important. We have
listeners,
to break that stigma.
Listeners, I think you all can relate to what Chris Morris is telling us, and I think part of what Chris is relating is this toughness, this ability to keep moving forward on the mission that we all learn when we serve. Chris, I want to thank you for your time today on Veterans Radio. I want to thank you for your willingness to continue to speak honestly about your military career and post-military health situation, and wish you the best of luck on going forward.
Well, Jim, I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for all you're doing and what you and your family have done for vets. And, you know, I, again, thank you for the time, and I hope that some of the things I've been able to say have at least given some of the younger generation, enlisted and officer alike, the courage to speak up and say, hey, something's not right. I need help. And to stand strong and continue to ask until they get that help.
I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host.
I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.